Kia ora and welcome to another podcast in the wonderful series People, Places and the Climate Crisis, where I have the privilege of interviewing 16 outstanding climate experts on climate and local government in the lead up to the local body elections in October. I'm Lindsay Wood from the Resilience Climate Trust, and we're running this series in conjunction with Fresh FM, the top of the South's community access radio station. At the end of the podcast, I'll give you details of other ways you can listen, including to Fresh FM's more condensed versions of these interviews. But now it's time for this interview with Penny Molnar, QSM. Penny is something of a legend in the Nelson region, and she will be extending the conversation we had last time with Dr. Joanna Santa Barbara in the area of social cohesion and climate justice. So I hope you enjoy this discussion with Penny Molnar. It's a special pleasure to welcome Penny Molnar, a stalwart of Nelson's community organisations, to this series of People, Places and the Climate Crisis. It's testimony to just how important her contributions have been that Penny has been awarded the QSM, the Queen's Service Medal, for services to the community. Examples of her involvement have included key roles in the founding of the Victory Community Centre, the Nelson Multicultural Society, and Community Action Nelson, as well as her being very active in numerous other community groups. Penny, you're also a trustee for different sports and cultural trusts, and if I'm not mistaken, you're an active waka paddler. How wonderful it is to have you on the show for our theme, A Just Transition and Social Cohesion. A very big welcome to you.
Thank you. Thank you. Lovely to see you.
We'll start in with the questions. You and your colleague, Kendra Douglas, are legends in the Nelson region through your long-standing involvement in various initiatives to support the disadvantaged. We know that climate-related impacts are taking many forms, from vulnerability of low-lying properties to the electrification of transport and to health-related issues. Would you please share with listeners how you see such matters influencing our quest to achieve a just transition to a climate-resilient society?
Well, housing, of course, is such a fundamental aspect of and necessity for our lives and for everybody. And I think Nelson is a really good example of a smaller city where there's a huge difference between those who have and those who don't have. And it's almost 50% of Nelsonians now are renting.
Wow.
And 90% of those are in private rental.
Mm-hmm.
And that just says it all, really, just how little control so many people in our community have over the stability of their housing. And of course, without housing stability and not being able to really say that my house is my home, people are not able to have other aspects of stability in their lives. You know, without a stable home, people don't find it easy to become part of a community, and their children are disrupted because they move schools, and all those sorts of things happen. So I think that the market system that we've been in for, you know, decades now has really disadvantaged those on low income. And But out of it has also come some housing, community housing trusts and organisations, which are starting to make a big difference. And I think that they are the ones that recognise the need of low income people. And they're the ones that are also putting pressure on council and government to make funding available for them to be able to build in ways that will make it easier for low-income people. So I'm hopeful that they will be the ones, plus the state housing, to build in places that give low-income people some stability. I mean, that's the hopeful side of it, but that's slow. And I'm not sure that people hear their voices get heard as well as they need to.
When you say their voices, you're meaning the disadvantaged people or yes. the lower socioeconomic people?
Yes.
Thanks,
yes.
Penny.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, one of the things that really disturbs me is how local councils don't seem to be able to control what developers do. And so the whole buying of land, and, you know, we've seen it already. Bexley in Christchurch was a really good example of land that was built on, even though way back in the when I lived in Christchurch, I remember family, my parents saying that should never be built on, it's swamp.
Wow.
You know, developers got the better of it. And what happened? Mm. Those people who were probably a lot of them first home buyers lost their houses.
In the earthquake.
And because of liquefaction. Will that happen in Lower Queen Street, where housing has been built that is you know, on very low-lying land?
So even if it's not liquefaction, it may be sea level rise or surface flooding or something like that.
Mm. Yeah, yeah.
Yes.
So I think councils need to be bolder. They need to be able to, what's the point in doing strategic planning and future planning, etc., and inviting citizens to participate in that by putting in their submissions, only to then be driven by the developers who want to make use the land that will bring them the best income.
If I can just interrupt briefly, this business of the courage of councils or the strength of councils is a recurring theme in these interviews. I've had a number of other guests who've, from different directions, said the same sort of thing. We need to have the resolve to make the hard decisions and things like that.
And I think even within council, there was a really good article, believe it or not, from Michael Laws in the Listener about what's going on within councils and how decisions are being interfered with, really, and the good democratic process is being interfered with. And that's really disturbing. So I think that there's also a place to change the way local governments make decisions from an adversarial point to more of a participatory process.
Yes, that's been another recurring theme too. Very interesting.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, there are places, Ireland has been one and other counties in Britain where they've had citizens assembly type things. And so when we talk about climate change and the effects on the low-income people, the more marginalised people, this is one of the ways in which I think we can make sure everyone's voice gets heard across the spectrum of society.
Oh, that's wonderful. Thank you. And the citizens' assemblies and other participatory movements, they have a structure, don't they, where they do nurture the people, because often I think the more disadvantaged people find it emotionally harder to engage as well. They don't feel as articulate or as well informed on the issues. Mm. And am I right in thinking that those more formal participatory processes give them a lot of support that they otherwise don't get?
Yes. And I think, you know, we can learn from Māori too, you know, iwi and what they're doing and looking at their housing, papakangai, etc. Is we need to learn from them. And I think councils and government need to be bold and not fear that community might know more than they do or feel like they're being led by them.
Even James Shaw, the Minister of Climate Change, who I interviewed first for this series, one of his comments was, we shouldn't have so much top-down consultation. It should be not telling people what they ought to agree to. It's more learning what is the right for them or learning their wisdom as well.
Exactly, yes. I've actually, in our book group, I've just read Melanie Gates's book from her, you know, what she's learned being with her foundation, and it's amazing. That is a really good example. And just yesterday, one of the things that we're doing in our CAN organisation, Community Action Nelson, is with the elections coming up, we've always held forums inviting the mayors or the councillors, candidates to come and talk to the community sector. This year, we've decided that we're going to concentrate particularly on the low, on the young voter.
Okay, good.
So yesterday I went and talked to the City Council's Youth Council. Most of them are still at school, but not all. And I talked with them about it, and they came up with some really good ideas on how to think about getting youth knowing about how to vote and why they should vote.
Oh, what a good move.
Yeah, so, you know, that's a good example of an oldie like me learning from them how to do things differently.
Good
and
on
how
you.
To do things appropriately for their generation.
That's wonderful, Penny. And otherwise, they become another, quotes, disadvantaged, close quotes, group, don't they? Because they're disenfranchised by a system that actually doesn't make it easy for them to participate.
Mm. And then we wonder why we have such a poor turnout at voting time, because they haven't learned that actually their voice can count.
Yeah. Penny, if you don't mind, I'd like to take that as a trigger to go on into the next
sure.
next dimension, next question. It has a social side to it as well. There often seems an emphasis on physical items in council responses to climate impacts. Coastal impacts like defences against wave action or flooding defences. And in fact, I think Westport has just had a multi-million dollar government funding put to that, protecting infrastructure and the like. However, important to these as these physical things are, it's well known that the most resilient societies at times of crisis are usually the ones with good social cohesion, coupled with a good element of preparedness for what might happen. If you were able to shape council policy in these areas, what would you prioritise in order to optimise the long-term benefits in these non-physical areas, in these social areas? There's a meaning of life question.
Well, I've probably touched on it already, because I think, communication, the people in power listening to what life is really like for the everyday people, finding ways of hearing their ideas, because, I mean, I guess why I get involved in community comes way back from when I was a lucky person to have been born after the war and lived in a small rural Canterbury town, where my parents were involved with lots of other parents and just doing what the community needed, whether it was, running the Red Cross, helping the elderly and make sure they were fed, whatever.
Or building a shed for the sports teams or something.
Exactly, yeah. And I think my dad taught most of the kids to swim,
Wonderful.
But it's learned from there. I've learned that community is can be really strong and can be and actually does lead the way. You know, if you look at most things, and I was just thinking about this, an example for me is Place Centre. Place Centre was set up after the war or at the end of the war for, particularly for women whose men didn't come home from the war, whatever. And it's gone on to be a very strong institution, really, and not just for the children, but for the whole whānau.
Oh, I'm with you on that. And it's very participatory too, isn't it? It's not
like
a government department running it sort of thing.
Right. And the same with Māori Women's Welfare League. They saw the poverty of for Māori women, Māori families that started moving into more urban settings. And it's from those powerful places that people have gained confidence and to then be able to speak up. So although we're talking about climate change, it's about making sure people feel confident enough to be able to speak up, to come together, to present their knowledge and their requests in a way that get heard.
Oh, fascinating. I'd like to dive into a couple of issues you've mentioned, Penny, if I may. Several people, you included, have highlighted the importance of communication. The subtitle of that I take from nearly everybody is, we're not getting it right yet. Therefore, you ask anybody, if we were to ask a council you know, what did you think about communication? They probably think they're already doing it. And so I'm interested to get your thoughts on what we should be doing in the way of revamping communication to make it much better. For example, I hear two-way is a missing element. Maybe it's a bit too much one direction, but I'd love your comments on that if that's not putting you on the spot too much.
Well, it's something that I'm always grappling with. I mean, I find now with the whole digital world, which is not one that I embrace wholeheartedly because I don't have the skills and I don't stop to learn the skills, really.
Welcome to the club.
That a lot of us, there's a lot of miscommunication purely because which channel do you use to actually gain the information
and reliable information too.
And reliable information. That's right. I mean, what is the truth these days?
You're right.
So I don't know, except I do believe that, and we've been through this whole period of time, of course, with the pandemic, that in some ways that's brought people together. That first lockdown period when people were out walking and talking to each other and recognising neighbourhoods and
looking out for each other a bit and things.
Yeah, and making sure their neighbour was okay. That I think that was a form of communication that we've lost in the cities, because we're all so mobile, we're so busy, we can be Zooming our family and friends on the other end of the world and not remembering what makes cohesiveness within our own neighbourhood.
Yeah, but not talking across the fence to the next door person.
Exactly, yeah. But I think, I do think that education, you know, kids learning about civics and about communication, one of the things that our CAN does is we often umbrella small organisations that are doing really worthwhile things. And we've just helped with umbrellaing funding for a woman who has an amazing program for preschool children to learn to communicate so that you know, you need to be able to talk before you can read. And so many children don't get the opportunity to have conversation and know how to talk. So, you know, it starts from there and it builds and it builds. And that's why I was so impressed with those kids yesterday, young adults, when I said to them, would they be interested in working with me on finding ways of reaching out to young voters? And there was a room of 15 and 10 of them put their hand up.
Super. That's wonderful, isn't it?
And I was sort of thinking, probably no one will, but there they were. And so that gives you hope. Yeah.
I'd like to say that's a compliment to you too, Penny, that they obviously responded to you personally in that way as well. That's lovely.
Yeah. No, it was great. Of course, it means more work now, but that we'll forget about it.
There's no shortage of that, is there? Can I jump to my other follow-on question from what you said before? It actually flows on from what we've just been talking about. You've talked about groups, if you like, in different ways. For example, when we're both of a comparable vintage and when we were kids, there was a different feel within the communities that we lived. You've talked about tangata whenua groups. And I'm very conscious that, for example, at times like the Kaikoura earthquake, the marae suddenly started to play quite a central role in the patterns of getting over what had just happened to them. And yet there's a feeling that goes with that, and it may be associated with the gradual diminishing of churches and the like, but there is a bit of a vacuum in mainstream New Zealand society in regard to that sort of cohesiveness and communication. Are you able to comment a little bit on how you see that?
Well, I think it's interesting because one of the things that I've become extremely and put most of my energy into now really is community centres. You know, I was fortunate enough to work in the Kaikoura community from 1986 to 2002. I used to visit there every month.
Okay.
And right at that time when the marae was getting really strong, they had fought for 15 years to get back that piece of land so they could actually build a marae.
Is that right?
And yes. Yeah, and they, there's a huge story about for that. But, you know, they were a really good example to me of the importance of having a place where people to come together. That, and there's a lot of conversation, a lot have been written about when we talk about community, we talk about place. And that's what I've loved about being part of Victory Community Centre.
Yes.
It's what I love about being part of the Women's Centre. And also the White House, which is a place for people with mental illness, which is a day centre for them that they run themselves in their way. It's a place where people can not only come, but they can belong and they can participate. Over the years, particularly since, you know, the early 90s, the neoliberal system, where government has pushed a lot of services out to community to deliver on their behalf, we've lost a lot of what is about that participation. And that's what gives people, empowers people to feel confident and also to feel like they belong. So that's what I love about community centres. They can get some help if they need it, but they can also give help. And they can, you know, we've just had Matariki at Victory Community Centre where, I don't know, probably about 800 people came. You know, a group of us made soup for over 500.
Wonderful.
And there we were, you know, a whole team of us making soup and another team making, doing everything for the hāngi,
yes.
The children performing, other groups came and performed. That's what community centres can do.
And can I dial that for? That sounds wonderful, but not everybody listening is going to think, well, that's cool, having a place where we make soup for each other. But if I dial that into a climate context where we might be facing upheaval, it might be extreme weather events, it might even be communities having to be relocated progressively. How do you see those sort of centres functioning in that context, Penny? Can you shed, where maybe, let's do a parallel with the marae in Kaikoura that we talked about. Can you comment a little bit on that for us, please?
Well, I think the importance of a centre is that A, it can belong to everybody. It is everybody's. So the fact that it is, and I say that very clearly to women who come to the women's centre, you know, this centre belongs to all women of the region.
That's an important concept, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And it's a very different concept from service delivery. So if the, you know, when there is a crisis of any sort, and whether it's, you know, terrible weather or you know, sea level rising or whatever, if people have a place where they can gather, a bit like the, you know, the in the old days, people all got into, went to the centre of the town, where, and together they can work things out. Together they can make sure who is very vulnerable and needs help. And together they can be giving that voice to the council or government of what their needs are. But if we don't have a place that feels a safe place to come, it's very difficult to then get the communication going.
Well, yes, when you put it like that, it's pretty self-evident, isn't it? But it's not a thing that we all realise. I'd like to dial on to another question, if I may, Penny. One of the compounding factors is that responses to climate impacts might be changes that come at a cost, such as relocating people or possibly increased rates to pay for physical works. It might be a seawall or one of the things we've talked about before. Can you kindly explain why such changes hit poorer communities disproportionately hard? And what sort of impact such things might have on their lives? And secondly, if you had a magic wand, I want to make you a magician now. If you had a magic wand, what sort of council policies would you conjure up to try to ensure a just transition?
Yes, yeah, it's very tricky. I know I keep coming back to this, but I just feel that one of the biggest things is we there's that wonderful man Hans Rosling, who I've read a little bit about. He's a Swedish man, and he says we must not forget the people in the margins, and that's what I keep. I'm not sure that whether I have any answers for what you're asking, other than making sure that all citizens are included, that we we've been driven by the marketplace for so long, and that it's been a top-down system, which means by the time we get further down, things get splattered. How do we recognize that? And I think through the pandemic, everyone realized the importance of the cleaners and
The
the
truck
rubbish
drivers
collectors.
and the yeah.
All of us are important, and how that there, yeah, I don't know. I don't understand economics well enough
No,
to
that's okay, but I'm going to dig around that a little bit. First of all, I'd like you to unpick the word splattered for me, if you like. You talked
either.
about it coming down, and by the time it gets down to the lower socioeconomic people, it gets pretty splattered. Can you elaborate what you had in mind when you used that term?
Well, I think people then have to, they get disconnected, they get forgotten, but they also get desperate. I can think of a particular teenager that I knew well when I was being a nurse at Victory who was out stealing. And she said, "Well, my mum can't afford it, and why can't I have it?" So, to me, that's a form of splatter. There's somebody who knows that they are not recognized or thought or cared for, but have the guts to go and try and do something for themselves, even though it's happens to be criminal.
Yeah, I'm with you.
So yeah, and I think we I guess we could say the growth of gangs is part of that.
I think a lot of people don't make those connections, do they, between the broader issues going on and the rise of more troubled components of our society as well. The other thing, you said you're no economist, but part of the what we're talking about, you talked about, for example, more support for disadvantaged people a little while ago, is whether we should be reprioritizing some of our civic funding. Now, I'm not advocating for that, although I've got my own thoughts on it, but I'd love to know what you think about, if I give you this magic wand again and put you on the council's treasury benches and say, this is how I'd like to adjust the way we spend money. I mean, for me, it would be perhaps more on climate initiatives, but for you might say, here's another way. What would it be in your mind or top of your agenda there, Penny?
Well, I mean, I'll put on my sporting hat here,
Oh, good.
because I'm not actually on any sporting committees, but I participate. And I think one of the things is that everyone wants the best facilities, and I think sometimes council wants to show that they've got the best facilities. But the importance of coming together again, where can various sporting groups share things, like tennis and squash, trying to share. And we need our tennis club needs some sort of a tennis pavilion, but it could easily be worked in well with with the squash club. I know through family who are involved in football, recognize that they don't have a clubhouse, even though it's the biggest football club in the South Island, in the Nelson area. But how can that be worked in with others so they don't have to be spending money just to look fancy? There are lots of those sort of examples. Again, it's about cohesiveness within the decision making, that would hopefully mean that money is spent wisely. I think it's amazing what community does in the way of caring for the planting and the vegetation of our city,
yes.
And the outer
the stream margins and the coastline and things like
yes,
that.
Yes, yes, and friends of the Mai Tai that have raised the standard of the Mai Tai River that everyone swims in. That relationship with the council to allow people to, again, really put their contribution into the city.
Can I just jump sideways and tell you a story in my own background there?
Okay.
I used to run an architectural practice in South Auckland. And one of the projects we had, we were asked by, I think, the councillor who was the head of the sports and recreation area, to develop a concept for a major sports field where they had a lot of different clubs to do a collective club rooms and facilities, just like you were talking about, all share them. We came up with this scheme. Actually, it was a pretty cool scheme, but it added to what they had. They not only had their normal changing rooms and showers, but they had a bar and they had places for coaches and meeting rooms and a gym, and, you know, because the collective. And you know why it fell over? Because the rugby and the rugby league people refuse to share club rooms.
That's where I think sometimes council needs to be bold and say, well, this is the way it's going to be.
Well said.
Which is sort of the opposite to what I've been saying all the time. But, yeah, sometimes it does need to lead. It needs to actually put its foot down and say, just as they need to the developers.
Yeah, there's bigger stuff going on here than that you don't like that. We better move on, I suppose, Penny.
Okay.
So thank you. It's fascinating. I could keep chatting for hours. I want to talk about public transport because that has quite a connection with disadvantaged or lower socioeconomic groups. It seems to me that the discussion about buses and bus fares that's been going on recently, where and how often they should run and how much they should be subsidised, illustrates many facets of the problems we're facing. It includes equity issues, it includes the question of short-term thinking. It may even include the issues of the fact that we get people on buses and it frees up more of the road for the people who are not on the buses. How would you like our councils to approach the question of public transport in the region, especially from a social perspective? But here's an angle that bears on what we've just talked about. And what trade-offs do you think we as a community should be prepared to make to that end?
Well, I'm a cyclist and I enjoy being able to bike into town. I happen to live by the shared cycle and walkway, and I think that more and more people are using that. So the more of that, that the safer cycling is, the more people will use it. I think one of the ways that we could include making it safer, and then therefore parents might be more comfortable about letting their kids bike to school, is to, we already have the reduction down to 30 Ks within the very tight CBD. I think that could be extended out at least a block or maybe two blocks. A number of years ago, we happened to have staying with us a man who is does all sorts of traffic management. He's from Holland, and he told us how, you know, Holland used to have traffic jams from one end of the country to the other. And he talked about, as soon as you lower the speed within the city, people start to change their attitudes.
They start to think about
whether they'll either hop on a bus or they'll park their car further away and they're happy to walk, etc. So I think that that's one thing. The other thing I've thought about is, you know, and I'm a good example, changing habits is always difficult. And because we live in a small town, I expect to be able to do all sorts of things in a day because getting from A to B doesn't take time.
Yeah.
So to change people's habits, to go from having your individual car that you can go and park right outside the shop, etc., and getting into the local bus, maybe it's a long, slow process, but maybe it needs to start with the kids, and all kids up to the age of 18 are always free on buses. So, you know, that they, by the time they become adults, they are really used to travelling on a bus and seeing it as a common way to get about.
Although you say it is a slow process, and I love the idea that you're saying, but isn't there a bit of a threshold thing that we have to have a point where we have to have enough buses But people yep. think this system's going to work for me. So you yep. can't just, you can't necessarily gradually creep to having enough buses, can you? There is a point of a courageous decision there, is there, where a council has to say, hey, we're going to commit to this level of frequency or something. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, no, I agree with you. What I meant was the slow process of the habit changing.
Okay,
well. But the buses. And I've often wondered about having, and I'm talking specifically about Nelson, but whether there is a constant loop between Nelson and Richmond. And it just, people can hop on, hop off. There can be some decent park and ride, you know, there, and maybe it's at the Well area. So that people know that it's running very frequently.
And they'll never have to wait more than 10 minutes or so, and a bus will come past.
Yeah.
Look, I'm with you. I'm quite used to parts of Europe where you say to somebody, when is the bus coming? And they say, look at you strangely. We don't worry about that. We just know it'll be here soon.
yes, definitely. Yeah. So they're the sort of thoughts I've had about Nelson, which is, I guess, an example of a smaller city of where we are used to using our cars and how to change.
Lovely insights again. Thanks, Penny. Well, all good things come to an end, but one of the delights I have of having specialist guests on this show is that I can invite you to close with your top take-home message. So I'm going to hand over to you for the population generally, but also especially for people wanting to factor things like climate change into the local government elections that are coming. What would be your absolute top take-home message for them? Over to you.
Most of us have some passions or interests that we personally follow, and they're the motivators for us. And so I think it's really important, whether it be, you know, bringing more birds back into our city, whether it be making sure our beaches are clean, and our water is clean, and the roads are safe. Whatever our passion is, follow it and speak up about it. And, you know, put in your submissions, or get a group together and talk to council about these things, to talk to the candidates. What is it that, why are they standing? What are they, how are they going to make sure that the citizens' voice gets heard?
Right.
Because I know that's what I've got out of it, is the people I've met, the fun we've had working together to try to work towards change. So, you know, the old adage, you always get a lot more out of anything that you put in, and that's certainly been true for me.
That's lovely, and that's a lovely note to finish on, Penny. Thank you. Thank you so much. It's been lovely talking with you and getting your insights.
Right.
A real pleasure to have you on this show. Thank you.
Okay. Oh, well, thank you, Lindsay. We'll look forward to I'm looking forward to hearing all the others too.
Well, once again, I'm blown away by the not only the expertise, but the depth of insight of these people. And Penny is no exception to that. So thank you, Penny Molnar, for expanding our knowledge in this important area too. Now, I always give you listening options for the podcast series. You can listen to the full interviews with each guest on their own podcast, and these are available on Spotify and Apple and on other main platforms, and can be linked from my firm's website, which is www.resilience, that is R-E-S-I-L-I-E-N-Z, www.resilience.co.nz, and there you can navigate to our podcast page. That will also give the full schedule of the podcasts, plus background information, as well as information on Fresh FM broadcasting frequencies and to podcasts of the radio shows, which has interviews condensed to about half their length. As always, a big thanks to Kahu Sanson-Burnett, who does a great job as sound tech and podcast whiz, And of course, big thanks to you, our listeners. Thank you so much for joining this important discussion. We have many more fascinating experts coming up on the series, and I do hope we enjoy your company for them too, including next up, Miriana Stevens, who's a director of Wakatu Incorporation, which represents iwis across the top of the South Island. And as always, kia kaha for the climate.